Ontario Premier Kathleen Wynne met with the Hamilton Spectator editorial board for an hour-long discussion, Monday, August 14th. She was accompanied by Hamilton MPP Ted McMeekin. Joining the discussion were Spectator editor Paul Burton, managing editor Howard Elliott, columnist Andrew Dreschel, and reporter Natalie Patton.
We might as well just start, and we usually start by letting you start us off, and then we'll have a conversation.
Okay, well, thank you. First of all, thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to be here. I will just say right off the bat, I'm not time-lagged or jet-lagged, but I've been on the Rainy River for the last few days with the Métis Nation of Ontario youth canoe trip. Jane and I did that, and then we went to the Human Rights Museum in Winnipeg yesterday. So I've come fresh off those experiences, which were fantastic. These kids, we joined them for their 80th and 81st and 82nd days. They started in Ottawa and are ending up in Kenora at the end of this week. So it was a remarkable trip. And I had the opportunity, interestingly, to hear them and to learn from them on their ancestors' heritage, but also to talk to them about some of the issues of the day, which was great. It was like a three-day-long focus group with 18 to 25-year-olds. So that was a real privilege. And we talked about a whole range of things. But they wanted to know why I and how I got into politics. I mean, that is always a question that I'm asked. And I think it's an important one to go back to, because why I got into politics is directly related to what we're doing today as a government and what I want to do going forward. And that is why you hear me and us talking a lot about fairness. I think right now, given what's going on in the world, there is a lot of uncertainty, and I'm hearing that. I hear that from people in communities. I hear about, kids. I hear from their parents and their grandparents about anxiety about what their kids are going to do, what their jobs are going to look like, what they should be studying at school in order to get the best job, and how they are going to, when I go to rural and northern communities, how those kids are going to be able to find work in their own communities, and that is a real challenge. So many of the things that we are doing are designed to try to address those concerns. So whether it is free tuition, which will start this fall for low-income kids in our colleges and universities, or whether it's the Fair Hydro Plan, which acknowledged that we needed to lower hydro prices for people across the province, but particularly in rural and northern communities where the distribution charges were very, very high, or whether it's lowering the minimum wage and finding ways to make sure that if someone's working a full-time job, that they don't have to go to the food bank, that they can look after themselves and look after their families. So the things that we are doing are directly related to why I got into politics in the first place, which is to address the issues of justice and fairness, and all of that needs a strong economy. And the real contradiction, and I'll end on this because I know we'll have lots of time to talk about it, but the contradiction in terms that we have right now in Ontario is that Ontario is doing very, very well. We are leading economic growth in the country.
G7.
G7, we're outstripping the United States. But people aren't feeling that. And people almost don't believe it when they hear it, because they don't see it in their own lives. So that's why it's even more important that government play a role. I believe government has an important role to play. One of the reasons that we're testing out the basic income is to see if there is another whole system that needs to be introduced in order to make it a fairer, give people a fairer shot at a decent life. So those are the things that are on my mind. Those are the things that we are doing. There's lots more. NAFTA is obviously something that we're thinking about every day, and I'm happy to talk about any of those things with you.
I'm assuming that your trip here was by car today?
It was.
And relatively smooth, was it?
It was.
Have you ever been down on a weekend?
Yes.
So you would know then that the QEW is jammed on Saturdays and Sundays between Oakville and Niagara.
True.
Does the government have a plan?
So you will know that we have extended GO service to Niagara, and that we're in the process of increasing that that GO service. I mean, that's something that Jim Bradley has been an advocate for many years, and it's something that we we're very committed to doing.
So it's working for sure for commuters on the way to work who are traveling alone, but for probably multi-person vehicles on the highway on Sundays, the road is still jammed.
Fair enough. I mean, our initiatives have been to, yes, to put in place things like HOV lanes and to try to manage the traffic. There has been expansion of highways, but building transit and increasing GO service has been a real focus of our government. And that, you know, that requires a culture change. I mean, it does mean that we're saying, you know, there's a different way to get around the GTHA, and that will only happen, I recognize this, that will only happen when it's more convenient to take a train than it is to drive. And I think we're getting to that point, which is why increasing that service. And it won't work, you're right, on the weekend, it won't work unless it's all day, it goes both ways. So that's the objective, and that's what we're working on.
And when might all day go come to Hamilton?
Well, I don't think we've got a firm date, but what I know is that over the next 5 years, we're going to be increasing the train service. So it will be incremental adding of trains in the same way that we're increasing the service to Kitchener-Waterloo. We will continue to increase the train service.
We've got that tracking problem with CN.
We have to negotiate with CN.
CN doesn't want to give up any more.
Is that
the issue?
We have to negotiate with CN in a number of places in the province. We have to negotiate with them track and either determine whether we need to build new track, which is happening in some places, or we can find a way to share.
And then, sorry, back to highways there. You have been reluctant to allow tolls on highways. Is that likely to change?
Well, we actually have implemented and are implementing high occupancy toll lanes, so we're not philosophically opposed to tolls, but there need to be options for people. So that's why if you're referring to the reluctance around the Toronto proposal,
yes.
There was no choice for people in those situations, and so that wasn't acceptable. And there had been no regional discussion about it.
So we have two highways here in Hamilton, as you may know, that provincial motorists use to cut through the city rather than using the provincially owned 403 or QEW, mm-hmm. the Lincoln-Alexander mm-hmm. Parkway and the Red Hill Parkway. Is there any chance that the government would, one, take them over, or two, allow us to toll them?
So I have seen a proposal on neither of those at this point. I don't have any idea whether council is thinking about that or whether there has been a proposal that's come to the Minister of Transportation or whether there's even been a full discussion about it at council. So I'd have to know more about it, and we'd have to have that conversation. But, you know, fundamentally, I'm open to, and we're open to, looking at options to find ways of helping people move around. At the same time, we're building $190 billion worth of infrastructure around the province. So it's not that we haven't committed to new build. We absolutely have, and we will continue to build. And within that, find ways to resolve particular bottlenecks or particular issues in communities.
And just before we get off this topic, what about photo radar? Can you see that being allowed on Ontario highways?
We have no plan to do that. Right now, what we've done is we're allowing municipalities, because we were asked, allowing municipalities to put photo radar in place in community safety zones and around schools. That's what was asked for. And from my perspective, it's a safety issue. And so, again, I'm not philosophically opposed. But we don't have a plan to put it on provincial highways at this point.
Premier, an LRT question. Mm-hmm. Recently, City Council has asked Metrolinx to basically change the procurement process for a bidder. They want, Metrolinx has to discuss this with the province, they want to basically have the leave the operation and maintenance in the hands of the City Transit Agency.
Right.
Is your government open to that?
Well, again, I know that this has been discussed, and I think it's going to council for another vote.
It'll be ratified on Friday.
Right.
I mean,
so
where that vote should go.
Right. So Metrolinx will need to look at that. And again, I think we need to be open to what makes sense in communities. And so Metrolinx will look at that, and we'll have that conversation. But I have no philosophical opposition to that.
Do you have a sense of when we might get an answer to that then?
Well, I would hope sooner rather than later. Again, I don't know what the timeline of the council resolution is, but it's something that Metrolinx would have to look at right away.
That issue was raised just for a point of clarification for the city council. As you know, Andrew voted on the acceptance of the LRT model. You know, there was some discussion, you know, prior to that, and I was intrigued that the city council, in their infinite wisdom or folly, didn't choose to raise that and make that part of the package before they voted on the approval. So now we're into a situation, Premier, you know, where
after the fact,
changing the the bidding system. Do you sever out the operate and maintain? What's the cost of that to the city? Would that be a new cost the city would pick up? If the cost were, say, $400 million over 30, 40 years, that might very well change the dynamic in the city around whether the city mothers and fathers would want to approve that. So those are the kinds of things that, digging a little deeper into, the council is going to have to deal with.
Yeah, and Ted, you're closer to it than I am. I don't know what the motivation is or what the outcome is that the city is looking for. I mean, obviously, we want these infrastructure capital dollars to go as far as possible, and we want to be able to build as much as we can. So anything that's going to undermine that is going to be a challenge. But again, I'm not philosophically opposed to looking at a different option.
Well, I'd like to ask at least one question about healthcare. In particular, we've had a situation here, you probably have heard something about in generalities anyway, in the last month or two, where the overcrowding problem and the unfunded bed problem and the lack of long-term care bed crisis, I might actually say, it's not getting any better. It's actually getting worse. I mean, there's absolutely no question about it. The number of people who can't get rooms, who are waiting in ER, you know, and the number of people waiting for long-term care beds is just astronomical, and that the wait times are. So what I hear from a lot of people who write letters to the editor and mm-hmm. comment on the website and that sort of thing, is what we've heard Minister Hoskins and others say is that, look, we've even heard our own Lynn say this. We're working on it. We're trying things. We're piloting this. We're doing that. And I have no reason to disbelieve any of that. But what I often hear from people is it doesn't look like anything is really working. It only looks like people are saying it's getting better and the situation actually is getting worse.
And you've got an aging population, which exacerbates it.
Which is only going to get worse in the next 4 years. So what reassurance, if any, can you offer to people who live in a place like Hamilton, which has an older than average population, that, yeah, we are actually going to make this better? Because it doesn't seem like that to them. It seems like it's getting worse.
Yeah. So I think the thing that is most important is that people know that what the specifics are that we are trying, and you know, what are the practical things that we think might help. I think for some time, people know that we've been putting more resources into home care and trying to help people to stay at home. And I think that there are more people who are getting more service at home than they would have 10 years ago, for example. But the building of long-term care beds as opposed to other solutions, that really is a challenge, because we've got people, and Ted's whispering, the ALC, so the people who are in acute care beds who need to be somewhere else. And we don't have enough long-term care beds to put them into. And so one of the things that we're looking at right now and is being piloted in some places is, can we work with retirement homes? Can we work with private providers to to put basically a subsidy in place that would allow some of that space to be used for long-term care, because I think that it's not realistic for us to actually believe that we can build enough long-term care beds distributed in the right way for all of the needs that that we have in the population, particularly in smaller communities, particularly in rural communities. At the same time, we know we need to build more hospice, for example. We need to have places where people can go for end-of-life care. So there is a whole raft of things, home care, other models of partnership with retirement homes, hospice, palliative, that will start to, and are starting to in some places, deal with the challenges that you're talking about. Because all of that backs up into the emergency room.
One model that the minister is looking at, and I only know this because I formerly served as Minister of Housing, would be to look at small transition units, say 100 square feet. Mm-hmm. And one of the things we were musing about was perhaps building something on campus, very small, but let it have a formal affiliation with the hospital, but not $112 a day affiliation. It'd be kind of a... You know, if there was an emergency situation, or you'd have somebody checking in, or there'd be, you know, a cadre of people that would relate to that, and we would deliberately place that as a transition kind of period while we did some of the other planning, Howard, around either enhanced community care that would, you know, release some of the pressure, or alternatively building some of those smaller units that seniors want to access.
And then there's another...
Hoskins is looking at that.
Yeah, and there's another model that we're not just looking at, but we are actually funding, and that is where there are concentrated groups of seniors who may already live in a small apartment building, that we actually provide some sort of collective care for that those people, as opposed to necessarily their individual caregivers, but there's a PSW or there's support in that unit, which isn't built by the government, which isn't built by the private sector, but is it's a housing development, but we provide the care. So we're doing a number of those things to address the concerns.
Well, the other thing that makes it difficult is that there are a lot of places that are not long-term care homes, they're retirement homes. But the challenges, the people going there are closer to, more akin to needing long-term care than being seniors that just want to retire and not cut the lawn, right? So that's why it's even deeper.
Yeah, I know it's very deep, and yeah. But I'm, you know, increasingly to people, and I don't, not to invalid, you know, anything you've said. I've read most of that.
Yeah,
I know it's all true.
Yeah.
But it just seems to people like, you know, if I was to say to you, so do you think in 2 years it's going to be a fair bit better for people? I don't know if you could really answer that. I'm talking about the people who are dealing with the ER problems and the ambulance bypass problems. And that's a frustration for people, because it's one thing to say we are doing a lot of important work. The LHINs are, the provinces, the local hospitals are, anchor institutions are doing work, the roundtable is doing work, and yet we're not really making much of a dent. And people say, well, when? When are we going to see something?
I think the other thing, and I don't know how many of you around the table are dealing with senior parents. I am. My mother's going to be 89 in October, and my dad's 91. And they're both at home. We have care for them at home. But one of the things my sisters and I are finding, and this is something I've heard from other people, is that the navigation of the system, the coordination, is really challenging. So our patient's first transformation is really geared at that. Is how do we help people to find their way through a system that often feels completely unsystematic, and people don't know where to turn, and they don't know when they've turned to one person who isn't connected to the other caregiver that they need. How do they make that connection? So I hope that in a couple of years, at least we'll be able to say, you know what, people are telling us that they are feeling that it's a more rational system, that they actually are able to get information in a better way, and that their primary caregivers are more connected to all of the other services that they need.
So
that would be a good benchmark for me.
With respect to Premier, we've been hearing that for years now. I mean, what were the LHINs supposed to do, coordinate all that?
Well, the LHINs were supposed to identify the gaps. The LHINs didn't have primary care as part of their responsibility, and that is a refinement, you know, that is a change that actually needed to happen. And I think there's some other things. You know, we have put a lot of money into family health teams, for example. One of the things that frustrates me about family health teams, and I have a lot of respect for the caregivers, the practitioners who work in our system, but we haven't always gotten the 24/7 care that we thought we were getting when we funded family health teams. We need to make sure that that actually happens, so that someone who is looking for a doctor in the middle of the night doesn't end up in the emergency room. And I say that advisedly, because I know that the stats show that most of the people who go to emergency room need to be in the emergency room. But there are people who end up there and end up waiting a very long time because they're not at the top of the triage list. And so if they had either an urgent care center or if they had access to a doc in the middle of the night, that would help them a lot. So yes, we have been saying this for a long time, and some of the things we tried have worked better than others.
So we've been saying this for a long time, and we all know in our hearts that the prices are going up. The number of people who are going to require more care because of our ages are going up. And you are hopeful that we're going to make improvements, but really, is that realistic, or do we need to sort of recalibrate our expectations for healthcare in the future?
Well, yeah, I mean, I would answer that question in a couple of ways. One is that the provincial governments are not in this alone. This is a national challenge. And so when I sit at the table with my colleague premiers, as I did earlier in the summer, this is something that we're all grappling with across the country. And so the reason that every one of the premiers was distressed by the latest round of talks with the federal government and healthcare was that we don't feel that the challenges were actually recognized in the way that they need to be. Having said that, we did get extra funding for home care and extra funding for mental health, and we will continue to work with the federal government to make the case. The federal government is paying about 23% of overall health care costs. The original deal was 50-50. The current agreement will take us over the 10 years down to 20%. I don't think that's good enough, and I think we need to continue to press the federal government on paying a fairer share of health care costs. So that's on the one hand. But that is not by way of abdicating responsibility. So the other way I would answer the question is, we don't have any choice on this. You know, we have to figure this out. We have to figure out how to manage ourselves. You know, as the baby boom ages, we are putting pressure on the system. And you're right. It's going to be more expensive, and it's going to be a challenge. We also are going to be a generation, I think, that's going to demand more preventative care, that's going to demand that we do things differently. I mean, I already have had many conversations with doctors about why do you not prescribe going for a walk? Why do we not have better pain management? You know, and that's related to the opioid crisis as well. Why are we not doing a lot of the things that we know will actually help people to avoid getting into the hospital in the first place? And that's a different tack than we have been on, I would say, over the last 20 years. So I think you'll see those things change. I think you will see people opting for different kinds of care. I think you will see people opting for different kinds of end-of-life care. And I mentioned hospice and palliative care. And so we don't know what those numbers will be, and we don't know what all those changes will be. But I'm not, as an Ontarian and as a Canadian, I'm not going to throw up my hands and say, you know what, too many people coming at us, we just can't do this. We have to start cutting the things that we will do, that we will cover with OHIP. That's not the direction that we'll go. For example, the OHIP Plus that we are putting in place, so the coverage of drugs for kids from 0 to their 25th birthday, That's an expensive thing, but it's also preventive. It's also preventive medicine, because if we can make sure that all those kids who don't take their medication because their parents can't afford to pay for it actually do, they're going to be healthier later on. That's why we started with young kids. So we're going to increasingly find ways to make better decisions about prevention, better decisions about care. And is it expensive? Yes, it is. But is it part of the fabric of a fair and compassionate society? Yeah, it is.
Premier, can you talk just a bit about how the PharmaCare Plus is a shot across the bow vis-a-vis the provinces and the federal discussion?
Yeah, I mean, it came up. I brought it up with my colleague premiers at the Council of the Federation of the Premiers and laid out what it is we're doing. So covering 4,400 medications for kids up until their 25th birthday. And I was quite upfront with my colleagues that I'm asked all the time about why we didn't make the program across the board. It is universal for that age group, but why we didn't cover the whole population. I was quite honest that we need a federal partner on this. You know, we need a federal partner to work with us. And there is a strong consensus across the country that PharmaCare is the missing piece of Medicare. And so each province has dealt with it somewhat differently. Quebec probably has the most comprehensive provincial approach if we look across the country. But there isn't a province where this isn't a discussion, and there isn't a premier that isn't looking to the federal government to say, let's take this to the next step.
Premier, opinion poll suggests that you personally and the Liberal Party politically is in a distant third place to the Conservatives and the NDP. Why is that?
Well, there are polls and there are polls. There are polls that show different numbers. And, you know, you'll have to ask the pollsters. You'll have to look at the research. My focus is on making sure that we do what we can, as I said, to make people's lives fair, to support people as they need to be supported. And whether people like me today or don't like me today is actually beside the point. It's more about whether their kid's going to be able to go to school, whether they're going to be able to get the health care they need, as we were just talking about, whether their community is going to get the infrastructure that they need. That's the focus of our plan, and that's what I've been working on. We'll have an election in June next year, and the people of the province will have the opportunity to pass their judgment, and I respect and always do respect that.
I don't suppose you'd like to reflect on some of the things you might have done differently if given another chance.
Just a weekend retreat or what?
There will be lots of analysis. There is lots of analysis as we go along. At every juncture, I try to look at the evidence. I try to look at the options in front of me. I mean, the Hydro One decision was a very hard decision for me. It was a hard decision for us. But I had promised that we were going to make major investments in infrastructure across right. this province. And we needed to realize some cash to do that. We can borrow a certain amount, and we obviously are, in order to invest $190 billion, but we also needed to realize cash, and we needed to take an asset that has served the people of the province well, hold on to 40% of that, but buy new assets that are going to serve the people of the province for generations. But that was a difficult decision, and it was a politically costly decision. I know that.
Yeah.
I understand that. But I believe that in the long run, having infrastructure that works for people in the province, that, you know, much of which should have been built 40 years ago,
yeah.
is actually the responsibility of government. It is hard to make long-term decisions. It is hard to make decisions about things that are going to be built, or policies or programs that we're not going to cut the ribbon on, we're not going to see the results of, we're not going to be able to see the fruits of until years hence. But that's exactly why they need to be done, because if governments punt those decisions down the road, for too long, which has happened with infrastructure in this province,
well, especially hydro,
then we we end up in a mess. So that's, you know, that's not a decision I would do differently, but it was a hard decision, and I know it was costly. But that's, you know, that was the decision that all the evidence demonstrated.
Let me pick up, since you raised it, Premier, one of the difficulties is that, you know, to be blunt, the hydrophile, for example, has been a problem child of governments, every government for the last 40 years. You may remember the previous government that tried to privatize. They let the system run down. They thought the private sector would buy in and fix everything. That didn't happen. We ended up with a $26 billion stranded debt and a government that found itself out of office and a new government coming in with a pledge to fix things. Tell them what's broken, how you're going to fix it. Good political advice. We fix it. $50 billion later, people are wondering why their costs have gone up, right? You know, and it's... and I think, you know, the new minister has creatively found a way of sharing that out. You know, if the assets are going to last for 40 years, why should people solely in this generation pay for the past mismanagement, perhaps, of every government, pay for all of that at once when it could be spread out and more equitably shared, and in the process, lower the price?
And we shut down coal. And we jump-started a green industry. That is part of this story as
good,
well.
Expensive things to do.
Yeah. I want to ask you about the green industry part of that, though, because with the closing of the pending closing of the plant in Tilsonburg.
I was just talking to the mayor.
A lot of people are saying, see, this is evidence that this, you know, the green promise, if you like, isn't living up to its billing. And in fact, when you look at the cost that has been incurred because of some of the contracts and the premiums and that sort of thing that are coming at that are being paid to, it's a pretty fair point to say, this doesn't look like it's working as well as it should. So maybe you disagree with that, but assuming that there's some truth to that, what are you doing to kind of make visible change so that there's, or is it just fine? Is it just all just a matter of perception?
You know, I think it's a dynamic industry. You know, there's new technology being developed. There's storage technology
costs
being developed right
down.
Now, for example. Costs of solar have come way down. That plant closed because the blades that were being built are not the size of the blades that are being used internationally. So it was a business decision that Siemens made. And it's unfortunate, but it's interesting. I just talked to the mayor, actually. I'm going to be seeing him also at AMO. But, you know, what he has said is that the people who worked in that plant are so highly trained that they're going to find other jobs. You know, it's in a transition, and it's a challenge, but they had a job fair, and there were companies, there were over 50 companies that were there that are looking for highly skilled workers. So there are industries that have developed because of the decision that we made that will become in export industries. There are skills that are being learned by people here in Ontario that will be transferable, and we've got clean air, you know. So do I think it was worth it? Absolutely. Is it going to continue to be a dynamic industry? For sure. And you'll see in our long-term energy plan that we, you know, which has to be adjusted every 4 years, you'll see that we're, for example, going to be including more storage capacity because there's new technology that's being developed. So I think, and that, of course, will make renewable energy more efficient because you'll be able to store the energy and use it, not just when the wind's blowing or the sun's shining.
And you now have people in the ag sector who are screaming about natural gas. Natural gas, natural gas, natural gas. Fair ball. We're doing what we can on that front. But my hunch is down the road, 20 years from now, we don't know what the take on natural gas is going to be. Very, very expensive to extend that out through low-density areas of Ontario, Howard. You know?
Do you think that Ontarians pay a fair price for energy?
Yes, I do. But, to Ted's point, the price of energy went up too fast and too high because of the investments that we had to make. And so...
And the delivery charges.
And the delivery charges. And so so that's why the Fair Hydro Plan takes those costs down by 25%. And
28 in Hamilton.
23 to 28%. and helps people in the rural and northern communities. So it was a spike that went up too fast and too high.
Do you think that Ontarians do enough to conserve energy? I'm not talking about the government, I'm talking about individual Ontarians.
I think that
good question.
We are learning as a community, you know. I think as a people we're learning. I think that we have assumed that electricity was infinite and free and we could use it with impunity. But I think we're doing much, much better. There's more that we can do. You know, I lived in Western Europe for 3 years, and that was 35 years ago. And we know that we're behind in terms of what other jurisdictions do in terms of conservation. But we're learning, whether it's in our public buildings, whether it's in individual homes.
Isn't that conservation in those countries dictated by the price of...
It has been historically, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely. Speaking of the...
But we've lived in a different reality here, and that's why it's taking time for us to adjust.
Speaking of the hydro rate cuts, the Auditor General says that the old rules governing government advertising have been in place. The current ads that your government's running, the province is running, would probably not be approved because they're so partisan. So why did you change the rules?
Well, let me just, when we say the old rules,
yeah.
If the old rules, as of 2002, before we came into office, there were no rules, right? There was no legislation that governed government advertising and partisanship. We actually brought in the rules, and then we modified them. We did not take away the notion that partisanship should not be part of government advertising. You may remember when the previous Conservative government was in place, there was government advertising that actually had politicians' faces on the ads, and we are not in any way interested in that kind of advertising. So yes, we changed the rules somewhat, but we did not take away the core principle, which is that government advertising should not be partisan.
Well, why did you change them? The first ones where you implemented seemed to be tougher. The Auditor General certainly thinks so. It certainly had their approval. Why did you water them down?
Well, we changed them because there was a sense that the way they'd originally been written, they were actually constraining the ability of government to give information.
Right.
And so the advertising that you see now sends someone to a website or gives them information about a new program or gives people information about a new policy. And that, I think, is fair, that government should be able to tell people what it is doing so that people understand when they either do or do not read the news, you know?
Yeah.
And so that's why we made the changes that we made. But the core principle, as I said, of partisanship not having a place in government advertising is absolutely still in place.
Yeah. Andrew,
the current act says, we've heard you. Who's we've? Who's that ad referring to? Is it the province or is it the governing party? We've heard you.
Well, it's the government. So the government is...
So it's a partisan ad.
Well, government is broader than the governing party. Government is also the civil service and the people who implement the policies of government. And there's a lot of input that goes into those policies that are drafted, that are worked on by people in civil service. It is, you know, it's a very important partnership, and it's a very important part of our democratic system that we have the governing party, the legislature, and the civil service all working together.
Andrew, we used to have ads come back.
Pardon me?
We used to have ads come back that were submitted for approval before some of the changes, where the you'd be doing...
Well, you do your ag ad with the red apple.
Well, Fruitland, Foodland Ontario, and came back and said you can't use red apples because that's partisan. We had commercials around bicycle lanes and the need to be better planners around bicycle lanes. And even though the bikes were different colors, there were too many red ones in the ad. you know, and that was to conjure up somebody somewhere thought, you know, this is some kind of conspiracy to get more liberal. Honest to God, Paul, I'm not making this up. You know, you can't make this stuff up. You know?
No, you can't.
So sorry, sticking with energy for a minute. Notwithstanding the green energy program, the Auditor General was critical of the management of the system. Do you have any? Do you agree with some of those criticisms, or?
I think there's lots of room for improvement in terms of the management of the system. I think that just to use Hydro One as an example. I mean, one of the things that is interesting about this situation is that before we made the changes around Hydro One, before we announced the changes around broadening the ownership of Hydro One, there was a hue and cry in this province about what a badly run company Hydro One was, and you know, you couldn't get through to them, and there was no customer service. And so, you know, there's been a dramatic improvement in terms of the way Hydro One relates to customers. It's not perfect, but is there room for improvement? Absolutely. I mean, I think that management of the system can always improve, and we take the auditor's suggestions and we take the auditor's opinion very seriously on all matters, but on that in particular.
I got to change the subject a little bit because I promised my wife I would ask this question.
Okay.
And you don't want to.
Oh, no, you don't.
You don't want to mess around
with her. Break those promises, Harry.
I'm kidding, of course, but I asked what she wanted me to ask. She manages a relatively small nonprofit agency in town. And she and we, our editorial board and at the Poverty Roundtable, were all big fans of the $15 an hour minimum wage change.
Yeah.
But she was telling me about the impact on her bottom line of a fairly small place. I won't get into the details, but pretty considerable and it's a nonprofit. And I've talked to a couple of small business people as well who, now I'm not talking about the Galen Weston argument, and I'm not talking about the Ontario Chamber of Commerce argument, but what I'd like you to say is, like, some of these small cases, like, there really are pretty legitimate concerns there. And so what sorts of things do you think you're going to be doing or on the table, or have you started talking about what sorts of things?
So we have started talking about it. In fact, Jeff Leal all summer has been going around the province talking
small
to
businesses.
He's got responsibility for small business as well as agriculture and food. And we sent the bill out for consultation with the standing committee after first reading, as opposed to waiting for second reading. So we're getting lots of input.
That's only been done about twice in Ontario history. Go out after first reading. That's how important that was.
So we're going to bring forward a package of suggestions, proposals in the fall that we hope will address some of the. Because you're right, it's the really small businesses. It's not. The large enterprises that may even not have a lot of minimum wage earners in their employ. So we're going to bring forward some proposals. The things that we've heard are things like training. You know, if we're paying $15 an hour and we're paying training on top of that, it makes it prohibitive. So there have been questions about training dollars. Other parts of Bill 148, like the scheduling, certainly the farm community has, small farm communities have raised the issue around scheduling because you can't schedule the weather, and so how do we make sure that we accommodate that? As Ted said, you know, seasonal workers who are earning the minimum wage but also getting room and board, how do we factor that in? So we are looking at what we can do to help those businesses with their paychecks. On the not-for-profits and on government-supported businesses, I mean, we're also looking, for example, at childcare and how do we make sure that those organizations can adjust to a minimum wage increase as well.
Going back to something you mentioned in healthcare, you were talking about family health teams.
Right.
So I think it was either last month or the month before we were talking to the physician recruiter here in Hamilton, and she's
Jane
saying,
Walker.
Yes, exactly. Despite a decade of work, we're sort of breaking even. You know, she's bringing more doctors here, and then some are retiring or going off elsewhere. And she mentioned that family health teams are a huge issue because of some of the restrictions that were put in place including in cities like Hamilton, because new graduates, that's the way that they're being trained. They're being trained in group models. So to come out and then have to work in that way is kind of counterintuitive. So is there anything that's being done?
It's counterintuitive for them to work in a family health team?
Being trained in these group environments, but they're not. Most of them aren't being able to practice this way in, you know, the majority of communities. So is there anything that's being done either to relook at these restrictions that were put in place or to somehow reconcile the training these doctors are receiving for them to enter the field more smoothly?
Yeah, the minister is looking at the family health teams for sure. And I think it's interesting, we're in a transition between that more sole practitioner team model, and I think that you've articulated it, where young graduates are actually looking for something that isn't in place everywhere, and they're actually being asked to replace a sole practitioner who has practiced a different way for many years. So I do believe we're in a transition, and I think that you'll see those changes. You'll see some of those changes will address the issue.
You're talking about some of the restrictions that
on the family
appear
health
to be in place.
Right.
I've had a recent conversation with the Minister of Health because there are some places in Hamilton where there's a dramatic shortage of family physicians, mm-hmm. particularly those working in what they call a HO.
They
have different names for family. My wife's a member of a family health team.
Yeah, they're fits and foes.
particularly on the West Mountain and the Ancaster, Southwest Mountain, the Ancaster catchment area there. Jane has acknowledged that as an issue. The minister has as well. And I've said quite squarely to the minister, we need to find a way to enable, empower young doctors, particularly those that want to work collaboratively so they're not on call every night.
Yeah.
To handle that. The other problem that the Wynn says we have is sometimes people say, well, an urgent care center will solve the problem. In some ways it does, but it also takes makes it easier. It makes it easier for family doctors, even in family health teams, not to be as reliably connected around on call stuff. So it's complex. There's no easy answer to it. I do know Eric, who's a Mac grad, by the way, and understands the model very well. He's looking at it very hard.
Yeah.
Can you go ahead?
I was going to say next June is not only provincial elections for marijuana. It's slated to become legalized. Initially, I think you had suggested you'd like to see it sold out with LCBO. What's your thinking there?
Well, we're looking at everything. It's interesting. This was a very urgent topic around the table with the premiers. There's a lot of consternation about unanswered questions and how much support we're going to get from the federal government on the implementation. And in fact, we sent a letter to the federal government saying, you know, these are the questions that need answering, like things around highway traffic issues and technology that's available and support for provinces that would flow through to municipalities to actually implement. So we've asked for responses on all of those things. But we're already doing the work here in Ontario to be ready for July 1st, 2018. I still am supportive of a government role. Whether it's the LCBO or whether it's some other entity through the AGCO, you know, I think that we need to have controls around this, and I think there needs to be public education, not just as in a campaign, but actually ongoing public education for people who are consumers, so that there's a heightened understanding of what the impacts of frequency of use, of the strength of the product that's being used. All of that needs to be part of the work that gets done, and so that implies that there'd be restrictions on who could sell.
So you would prefer like a government's control outlet?
Yeah, I think there needs to be government control around this. And it's interesting. I've had a conversation with a number of young people about this, and there isn't disagreement about that. I mean, it's young people who have said to me, you know,
we know that in the medicinal marijuana dispensaries, there are people who really understand cannabis and can give information. We think that kind of thing should be in place, even for the recreational marijuana. And I was, you know, I was impressed that that was the attitude. So I think there does need to be a government framework around it.
So just to pick up on that, then, if you can go to about 25 years ago or more, one of your predecessors promised us beer and liquor in the corner stores. And you've made a very, 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 very tiny step in that direction. How's that going?
Well, I take exception to the minimization of the,
talk about the
opening of our liquor laws.
Yeah.
You know, as we looked at, because this started with the beer store and how we could make that a more rational entity and the distribution more rational. And there's a strong sense that having control, I mean, talk about cannabis, people in Ontario like that there's control around the sale of alcohol. You know, that is a widely held belief that the LCBO, the beer store, do good work. Do they want more convenience? Yes. And people were very happy at the idea that they could get beer and cider and wine now in some grocery stores. But we've not had a lot of calls for opening up the liquor laws more widely.
But nothing bad has happened in the places where you have put them in, like in the corner in supermarkets or
even farm markets.
I mean, or even in Northern Ontario, where it's just a corner store with a LCBO sign slapped on it to make us feel like, ooh, it's all safe and
we're
controlled.
It's an agency store, right? Well, you know, it's a model that has worked. It's a model that brings revenue into the provincial government that pays for many of the things that we talk about in terms of services. And so, and we can rely on, you know, the person who's selling that that wine or that beer or that cider, as we will, I hope, with cannabis, having some information and having some responsibility to make sure that it's a safe interaction.
I'm just getting that time signal here. We've got 5 more minutes. So
we're good.
We won't go over. One of the things that we hear a lot, and at the Spectator, and we hear it from people in the community and stuff, is that Hamilton has sent a ridiculous amount of mixed signals around his support for LRT. Not the only thing, but for one. Do you have that view that you've heard a lot of conflicting and mixed signals? And is that, you know, people say, well, we look, you know, oh God, we look stupid because we can't seem to tell one story. You think there's something to that?
Well, I will just say I was the Minister of Transportation in 2010, so I've been paying attention to this discussion. It has, you know, it's gone on for some time. I understand that there are lots of sides to these issues in a community, and so I think we have to be patient. My fear has only been that the controversy would actually derail, if I can use that word, derail the building of the infrastructure, and that would be a huge shame, and that is something that we have tried to avoid. And so I want to see the transit built. You know, I want to see Hamilton get what it needs in terms of upgraded transit.
Okay.
I have to ask you about the debt in some sense. I understand we're up to about $311 billion now. It costs almost $1 billion a month to service it. I read that that's the third highest expense that the province has. You spend more servicing the debt that you built up than you do on post secondary education. How are you going to sustain that? Is it sustainable? What are you going to do to control it?
Well, we have to look at debt to GDP, and you know, our commitment has been that we will we would balance the budget, which we have done, and that we would tackle the debt to GDP, and that you would see that debt to GDP go down, and that has been our commitment. We want to see it go down to 27%, which is what it was pre-recession. There is no doubt that as a response to the recession, we made huge investments in this province. That's why the economy is growing the way it is. You know, it's why we see our unemployment numbers going down. And so when we look around at other jurisdictions and we recognize that our debt to GDP is not by any means the highest of many jurisdictions, we know we're tackling it. Balancing the budget was an important step, and getting that debt to GDP down is our commitment.
The Auditor General and others challenge your balanced budget. You say you were basically cooking the books.
Well, obviously I don't accept that. I reject that categorically. We've worked very hard to work with the Auditor General and work with the Financial Accountability Officer and follow all the rules that the accountants have in place.
Thank you very much, Premier.
Thank you.
I appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
One final question. How hard did you have to work to get Ted to run again?
You know, I was thrilled when Ted came in and said to me that he was going to run again.
He didn't come in and ask you, should I run again?
No. Ted and I meet every week. Ted is my my parliamentary assistant, and I would say more than that, a friend and a mentor. And you know, the thought of him not running again was pretty hard for me to deal with. But when he came in and told me he changed his mind, and that Judy Partridge was going to run, and we're going to have the opportunity to do those nominations today. I mean, it's a validation for me of what we are doing, because Ted, as you all know, has a very clear a clear view of what's morally right, and so the fact that he believes in what we're doing and he is willing to stand again for election suggests to me that we're on the track that I want to be on. We're on the track that that I think is going to lead to that fairer place.
Andrew, let me add a couple of things. Because I wasn't sure. And,
I know.
My wife, Barb, went to, as she does every year, to Guatemala on a medical trip. And she, sees hundreds of kids up in the mountain clinics, and they get vaccinations and all that stuff. And she came home. I picked her up at the airport. I shared this story with you. I picked her up at the airport, and suddenly she started crying. And I said, honey, what's the matter? I know it's just, sort of cultural stuff, coming home to rich North America. And she said, well, between sniffles, she said, I understand, not sure I'm getting your words exactly perfectly. She said, I understand in a new way what public service is all about. And that's why I fell in love with you, and that's why I want you to know that if you decide to run again, you've got my blessing and my support. Now, I don't need her blessing. I need her support, but it's nice to have her blessing and support. So I went in to see the Premier, and I said, I told you the story, and I have more miles to walk and promises to keep, Andrew. I continue to be consumed with this gap between the richest of us and the rest of us, Howard, and there's some other things I want to do on the housing front, and being unencumbered by being in cabinet has actually been helpful, I think, to me and to the city, because I'm able to focus in and on things that I would not have had time for if I was up to Wawa talking about revenue, or up in goodness knows where talking about social housing. Now I can bring it home and use all of whatever giftedness I have to focus on making Hamilton better.
And there are voices in caucus that are, all the voices are important, don't get me wrong. Every member of caucus is important. But Ted has a life experience and a worldview that helps a lot of us to test what it is we're doing. You know, he provides us a benchmark, whether he's quoting Kennedy or he's telling us some other historical story. He gives us benchmarks against which to judge our actions. So that makes him extremely, extremely valuable.
That was the audio of an August 14th Hamilton Spectator editorial board discussion with Premier Kathleen Wynne, Hamilton MPP Ted McMeekin, Spectator Editor-in-Chief Paul Burton, Managing Editor Howard Elliott, columnist Andrew Dreschel, and reporter Natalie Patton.